Welcome to This Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amadé, host of World Poetry Open Mic and The Michael Amadé Show, publisher of World Poetry Magazine, musician, poet, and author of more books than I should mention. My collaborator and co-conspirator in this project is none other than Clifford Brooks. Cliff is the author of Athena Departs, The Draw of Broken Eyes, and Whirling Metaphysics. He's the founder of the Southern Collective Experience and is a creative force behind the Blue Mountain Review. Our guest today is Jimmy James. Jimmy James is a man of another era, an old soul with an encyclopedic knowledge of 60s soul music and the creative drive to evolve that sound into the future. His guitar phrasing, tone, and temperament are something truly creative and inspiring. Born and raised in Seattle on a steady diet of soul music, gritty R&B, blues, and Jimi Hendrix, through his influences and his own deep explorations into music, he has crafted something truly special and original. He's a guitar man behind The True Loves, Tiffany Wilson, F2D, aka Funky to Death, and so much more extended WeCoast family music. He's a definitive part of the WeCoast house band and always has a place for his endless licks, colorful phrases, and tasty chops. He's part of the Delvin Lamar Organ Trio. He's an original member of F2D, Funky to Death, and the legendary live Friday night show at Seattle's Sea Monster Lounge. Without any further ado, here is our interview with guitarist Jimmy James. Tonight on This Business of Music and Poetry, we sit down with Jimmy James, a guitarist of great renown whose name is almost as fun to say as his music is to hear. Jimmy James, how are you doing, boss?
Man, just hanging tough and just glad to be on the interview, man. Just glad to just talk about music and all the other stuff, you know?
I do, and we're going to get knee deep in all of it.
Oh, yeah.
I want to jump in with both feet and ask the question that I think everyone always wants to know first, so I'll knock it out. How did the guitar grab you? What inspired you to make that your muse?
Well, I'll tell you. I remember the first time I heard My Girl by The Temptations. And most people wouldn't know who the guitar player's name is. His name was Robert White. He was the session guitar player in the Funk Brothers for the Motown House Band. And when I heard that, and I heard the guitar, Eddie Willis, who was also one of the other guitar players on in the Motown House Band, his guitar part, melody in I Second That Emotion by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, that's what got me. But My Girl, all the time. Like, if I ever want to feel like where I started, I feel like a little kid, I can hear that song, and it just always sounds great to me.
I was watching, and correct me if I'm wrong, I was watching a documentary, I think it was the Jazz by Ken Burns, and they got into the latter part of the show, and they were talking about the guitar she just mentioned that did My Girl, and he was sitting with a friend in a restaurant, and the song came on the radio, and he almost said, that's me, and then he didn't, and his friend said, well, why didn't you speak up? And he felt like the riff, that his sound was being stolen. And he wasn't given the proper credit. Am I making that up or is that true?
No, that's true. He was, he also said nobody would ever, he didn't think nobody would ever believe him because the truth be told, when that song started, it was very straight. It was very, just like a C major to F major. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. And the band decided to do something different. And so Jamerson came up with the famous bass hook that doom, boom, boom, doom, boom, boom. And then the guitar part was never written. And so Robert White was going to actually trash that guitar part. He said he didn't think it was good enough. And so he was going to get rid of it. And that was going to be the end of it. And they were like, oh, just keep it. And they kept it. And it's hard to imagine that song without it because that part makes that song. Like, yeah. You could play that part anywhere in the world. You can play the first few notes of it. As soon as you go, dun, 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 that's it. Everybody knows what song it is, just based off of that. And it's sad that he didn't get the credit, you know, or the writing credit for that guitar part. And most people didn't even know who he was. I didn't know it until I did, you know, my research information on him. And, you know, there's a video of them in the studio and it shows him playing it. And it's only a few times. And there was another interview where he plays a little bit of it himself, but most people wouldn't know unless you're like really deep into that stuff, you know?
Right.
And it's, do you, when you, like, there's, do you feel more purpose to make your sound yours, seeing things like that happen to great men that create these legendary sounds? I mean, when does it boost or strengthen your resolve to make Jimmy James sound yours and yours alone to where it's heard the same way?
Well, I remember there was a quote I heard from Miles Davis where he said, it takes you a long time to sound like yourself, you know, mm-hmm. and you have to accept mm-hmm. whatever that is. And what I think, and this is how I look at my philosophy on it, is this: you take your flaws, you take your strengths, and you take that and you own it. You know what I mean? And you're just being yourself. It's not what everybody else says. It's what, how you feel. And it doesn't matter what guitar you play or with your heart, because it's 95% the player and 5% the instrument. And right. So it's like, you know, and I mean, I've read certain things that, you know, interviews to certain people. It's like, for example, Jimi Hendrix, he can play the first two notes. You know, it's Hendrix. Just because he was mm-hmm. just himself. He could have played on any guitar. And I've seen clips of him playing on different amps, different guitars, but he still sounds like himself, no matter what instrument it is, because it's all in your fingers. It's what you play. And mm-hmm. you know, again, I saw a lot of quotes out there, but I'll go yeah. back to James Jamerson, who was the great legendary bassist on Motown. He told his son, if you don't feel it, don't play it. You know? And so you just have to be yourself. It's not going around and saying, well, we need to do this because this is what was said here and there. It's, you have to play what you feel 100% is you. And if you don't, then who are you? You're just existing.
It's true. It is so true, man. And, you know, today, as you stand in the music world, when I found you, it was in a video a friend sent me of a set you did with D'Lo 3, the Del Von Lamar trio. And your eyes are closed and you hold the guitar almost straight up. And I can see it when I talk about it. You have this transcendent look on your face, like you were someplace else entirely. And wherever you are, I'm jealous of, because you look really happy. Where do you go when you get into the groove, man? I mean, what do you feel, that channel? Do you feel that energy of something bigger playing through you?
Well, I put it this way. It's like, I'm not even thinking about it. It's kind of like, take for example, you go to bed at night, right? And you're not thinking of it. And when you get into a deep, light sleep, you're not thinking about it. You don't know where you are, but you know it just feels right. And that's what it is for me. It's like going into a deep, light sleep. You're not aware of what's around you. You're not there. You're just in this this endorphin, I don't know if you could call it, but you're in this deep state. And it's like, you're not really feeling it. It's just, you're just going with the flow. It's a flowing stream of consciousness, you know? And I don't really think about it, because it's like, when I'm playing, it's just what I'm feeling. But at the same time, it's also, maybe it's a little, it's that, it's also, it's just being in this other place, you know? And it's hard to describe, because you can't put it into words, you know? It's, there's no words or anything to describe it, you know? It's just that I'm just there, and it's the moment. And I guess that's what you could call it. It's just the moment in which it's like, that moment's different from day to day, you know? And I can't really say that it's going to be like, oh, I can remember what I played yesterday. It's just like, it's like the weather. Is the weather going to be the same yesterday? Is it going to rain? Is it going to sun? Is there going to be a tornado or a hurricane? We don't know, you know? And so that's how music is. It's like, I don't know what I'm going to feel that day until I step on stage and I hit, you know, even if I know the song I'm about to be playing, I still don't know what it's going to be until I hit the strings in that moment. And it's a thing to look at, even from, like, you know, what your audience is or how they're feeling and how they're responding, how you're responding. And it's a 50-50, it's a give and take. You know, and they might feel this way, like, as soon as you come on stage and they feel like this, or maybe they're not feeling so good. So you try to bring a smile to their face, you know, and try to uplift their spirits, because that's what music is, you know. And my belief, music is like church, You know, whether if you're religious or not, it's like church. You go there to whatever bad things have happened in your life, you go there to lose it there so you can come back out on Sunday, and then following Monday, you're feeling like the burden has been lifted. And that's what music is. It's like your church congregation, not even just the church congregation, but everybody come in there and they feel like they can participate and everybody's all at one and everybody's feeling the spirit. You know what I mean? And that's how I look at it. And I know it's just some people who are not going to, you know, are not religious or what have you, but that's besides the point. I'm not speaking of it to push any religious thing or anything like that on anybody. It's just more of people come there to feel a certain way. They come there to feel good, to lift their burdens. And that's what music is. It's there to you to lift your burdens and to feel good, not just a musician, but the people in the crowd. You're bringing some kind of joy and happiness to their life. That's what I think, you know. Sorry to go on a tangent there, but.
No, that was awesome. We could hit the show right there, dude. That was the best. That took me to.
No, I think the thing that you're talking about too is something that from a musician standpoint is really important too, because it takes a fluency in your instrument to be able to do that, to be able to react to the moment. You need, you know, you can't just be stuck in pre-written. I mean, you can still change the dynamics and the feeling behind pre-written parts, of course. But as far as like what it sounds like you're talking about though, is also being fluent in the ability to actually craft your performance, craft what's coming out in response to what's happening in the room. And I think, could you speak to musicians or even, I mean, this applies to poets as well, or any creative person. Could you speak a little bit to the development of your craft and how important that is in doing what you just talked about?
Well, it's just like my thing, how I look at it is this, that playing who you are 100%. And if it's anything less, then don't do it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like you have to, like, developing, and that's going to keep over time. We're always learning. Musicians are always learning. There's never a day that you stop. You know, and the minute you say, oh, I learned everything I need to know, well, then what's the point? You know what I mean? It's music. It's always, you're always learning. You're always expanding. It's just like, music is just like being a human. You know, you're starting from, as a baby, you're expanding, you're learning, you're growing. That's what music is. Music is like you start off as a baby. As humans, you never stop evolving. You know, you don't act the same way you did when you were 25. If you're 35 now, you're not doing what you did when you were 25. At least hopefully not, you know? It's like, I look at stuff that, okay, I did this a few years ago. Oh man, now I learned something new. I won't play that no more. I play it differently. Like, I could listen to recordings that I did back then. I was like, whoa, I could do that differently than I did when I first did that, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you're always constantly expanding. And it's just like, and then I could look at myself now, and then years later, I'm like, oh, I could do it different than what I did at this current moment. And then that, then 5-10 years later, there's another moment. I'm like, oh, I could do it better than what I did then. You know what I mean? And it's always evolving. You're always trying something new all the time. And so with the craft, it's like, at the same time, you have to be yourself. You know, again, I like to throw another quote out there. Oscar Wilde, the poet, you can only be yourself because everyone else is taken. And that's true. And so be who you are. It doesn't matter, like, hey, this is what the new thing is and what the new kids are doing or what everybody else is doing. It's at the end of the day, it's who are you? What are you? What's your voice? Who are you trying to be? Who do you want to be? How do you want people to hear you? But you also got to know that you have to be 100% who you are. And if you're not, then what's the point? You know? It's like when I get out there on stage, I'm just being myself. Me and Del Vaughn, we get out there, we're just being ourselves, you know? We don't know what it's going to be, and we don't know how it's going to be, but we just know we get out there, we're like, man, well, we'll see if we make it through this one. We'll try, you know what I mean? We'll try certain songs, like, I remember when we did one of our tunes called Chicken Leg, and we had learned it at the sound check in Austria. And I said, I was sitting there, I went backstage and I was like going to go get something. I hear Del Vaughn playing something. I said, what's that? He's like, oh, I got this tune. And the drummer who we were playing at the time, named Michael Duffy, he was wearing shorts and his legs were skinny. So he called him Chicken Leg, right? And and so it stuck. And I said, man, what's that? You know, he was playing something. And I said, man, I said, keep playing that. So I'm going to go put my guitar cases away. I plug in and I come up with the guitar line. He's like, you want to play that tonight? I said, sure, why not? He's like, so Del Vaughn gets up there. We're going to try this tune, you know, we got. And we just learned it at sound check. You know, we'll see what happens. We don't know what's going to happen. We're flying at the edge of our seats. Like, oh, we don't know what's going to happen. And we just get out there and try it. And it's like, You want to try it tonight? You know what? Why not? And he's like, if it's a train wreck, oh, well, you know. But at least we tried, you know. And that's the great thing about it. Because, you know, some people want to be super prepared, and I understand that. But sometimes you're like, you know what? Throw caution to the wind and say, you know what? If it derails, it derails. But somehow we could hit the emergency brake, and we might teeter-totter. We might not fall off the cliff too much, but we get there just enough, you know? And that's the beauty of it. You know, it's just taking a chance. And you never know unless you try, you know?
That's a beautiful answer. The you were talking earlier about My Girl, and I think I think many people, but I know every musician I've talked to, including myself, has moments from our history where we've heard a song and we're like, what the hell is that, you know? But then the question comes from, okay, you hear My Girl, you hear these other, you know, musicians that come up around the same time. How do you get from there to here? Now, I know that's a long story, but what was your first steps? Like, what was the steps that got you down the path you're heading now?
Listening to blues, you know? Like, yeah. I listened to that, but I was also, like, when I started, I listened to, like, I like Chuck Berry, you know? Mm-hmm. And I heard Chuck Berry, and I heard Elmore James and Muddy Waters and Herbert Sumlin and Howlin' Wolf. And then I remember when my sister, rest in peace, both of them rest in peace, I remember my sister, she loved classic rock and heavy metal. She was a drummer herself. And I used to bang away on the drums before I played guitar, but guitar was still always my first love, but I was just banging on drums because it was an instrument in the house. And so I remember she had Jimi Hendrix smash hits on cassette. And I remember I heard Purple Haze for the very first time. Scared the living daylights out of me. That and Foxy Lady. And I thought it was metal for what I heard. Uh-huh. That's what I thought. I thought it was current at the time. So I held it to myself and I said, man, I want it. And I looked at Jimi Hendrix. I said, I want to see him when I get older. And so when I got to an age, I was like, I asked my sister, I said, so where can I find Jimi Hendrix? Is he coming on tour anytime soon? Of course, I was told the horrible truth, and I was very upset because I waited all them years. Because I was like, I was hoping he was going to come to a concert in Seattle. Well, that was not going to happen. So, you know. But
yeah.
Speaking of that, I would sit there, I would listen to blues records, and I would try to learn and mimic what they were on the records. And then I would watch, like, one guitar player I knew in Seattle. His name is Ari, and I used to watch him. You know, he would go, I would follow him to house parties, and I was like, shoot, I was like 12, 13, uh-huh. You know, and I would go watch him, you know, and they were playing music, and I'll sit there and watch him. Another guy, he was like a father I didn't have, Coleman Brown, he played with a group called Septimus. And he would actually let me in the clubs. I know I'm not supposed to say this, but he would let me in the clubs when I was underage. So, of course, I tried to grow a mustache, you know, and to darken it up, I used my mother's mascara to try to darken it up so I could look like it was older than what I was, as long as I didn't hang near the bar, you know, and I'll try to talk it, because my voice was doing this at the time, so I was trying to talk, like, I was like, hi, I was trying to get as deep as I could get it and try to get in the club, you know, and he's like, make sure you don't hang near the bar, you know. And of course, I don't drink alcohol. It just ain't my thing. But I would sit there next to, the band and watch them. And I would sit in with them, and people like that. And so that was what I would do. I would go around and I'd watch other cats play, and watch what their fingers were doing. And be like, man, what's that you're playing? Because I didn't even know what I didn't know what a minor and major chord were. I would just call B sad chord. And then that'd be a minor chord. And I'd be like, B happy chord, because major sounds happy. So I'd be like, happy chord, sad chord, And then if it was a chord I didn't know, I'm like, B weird chord, And that's how I knew it then. And so, and I still kind of do that every now and again. But I would watch other players and be like, man, what's that? What's your fingers doing? Oh, that chord sounds sweet. What's that? That sounds great, And then somebody was like, oh, it's minor 7/11, whatever, And I'm like, okay, And I said, well, I can't remember that, so I'll just call it B weird chord or B weird number 2 chord. And that's how I remembered everything at the time, But now I can call it by its proper name. It's like weird chord. Oh, that's a diminished. But I just called it weird chord because that's what it was at, for me at the time.
I mean, that's a really authentic way to get into it, though, too, right? Like, I think it becomes this thing where you're just like, what? I'm just trying to find words to describe all these different things, and then I need to figure out words to describe these different things that other musicians understand, and that's really the process, But yeah, I can completely buy that. And by the way, I got pulled into clubs underage too to go watch music back in the day, and that was such a great formational experience. Kind of cool hearing that you went through the same sort of thing. Like, that's, to me, I remember that some of my most sacred times with music for me are those moments, So tell us a little bit about Delvon Lamar. How did you start your work with him?
We saw each other on and off, and I remember there was a club date. There was not a club date, it was a jam session downtown. And I came in there, of course, I was still underage still. I wasn't 21 yet, but he said, let this cat on stage, and then played. And then that's how we got to know each other. And I would see him on and off for years, and I knew he was the big deal. I mean, there was other organ players, but there was something special about him that I liked, because he played in the vein that I was into. And so I would see him again with his other group in Bellingham, opening up for Budo's band, and he asked me to sit in. And then when D-Lo 3 started, they started at this club called the Royal Room. And they had another cat playing guitar at the time. And I guess things didn't work out with that cat. So he said, man, what? He called me. He's like, Devon's like, hey, man, because that's my impression of him when he talks. He's like, hey, man.
It sounds just like him.
So, won't you come on down here and play? I've been around him long enough that I could do that. He knows I do that. And he's just like, and we laugh about it because he's like, do I really sound like that? I was like, yeah, you do. So, he tries to do an impression of me. He can't do it. And I will say this, I don't care if he hears it. He knows he can't do an impression of me. Because his impression of me was like, James Jamerson. I'm like, I don't sound like that, but he'd be like, yeah, so we're gonna do a song called Tacoma Black Party. But anyway. so he was like, yeah, you want to come on down here and play? So I was like, I said, sure, man. I said, but I don't know half them songs that you guys are playing, like that stuff down there. He's like, man, just come on down here. I said, all right. So I'm bringing my guitar when you start playing. And he's like, man, what do you know? He's like, you know this tune? I said, yeah, I know that tune. He's like, you know this tune called I Don't Want Nobody to Give Me Nothing? He said, by Grant Green. I said, well, I know the James Brown version. I don't know the Grant Green version. But I said, we just did a mishmash of different things. And so we pick each other's brain. Oh, you know this? Well, shoot, you know this? Well, you know that? Well, you know this? And that's how it started. And we started playing down there. And then a lot of the songs that became Close But No Cigar on that album started as loose things down there. Devon will have an idea, like the title track, Close to the Cigar. He came up with an idea. He had the bass line and the organ part. And I said, man, what's that? And I said, well, I got a guitar part that'll fit it. So I just start playing it. And then we just did that. And our manager, Amy Novo, You know, she was the one who was just like, put it together. So, because he didn't want to put a band together anyway. But she's like, I'll handle all this. And so she handled all that. We are where we are, you know?
That's great, true, man. That's cool how those things happen. Connect, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is. It makes me wonder, what are you reading right now? I mean, do you read any poetry right now or anything? Because the way you talk about music, the way you get lit up, the way you glow when you talk about where your inspiration is. Do you ever read poetry to kind of get into the mood?
I read quotes from like people. Like I watch documentaries, and it's just like you hear certain things. Like I remember in school, I used to write like haikus, and I used to write poetry and stuff like that. And I used to read like quotes from different people and different books and stuff, you know, because I used to read in like encyclopedias and dictionaries and stuff. And I guess it got to like my teacher kept telling me, she's like, you know, have you ever thought about being a journal or a novel writer? Because I remember I used to write like not only poetry pieces, but she asked us to write like some stories, you know. Uh-huh. And I remember writing a story, believe it or not, this is true, and I don't even know where the book is, if I could find it, but I remember making this this story about this purple fictional planet called Keptar, something like that. Uh-huh. And I remember I said in the story, it was supposed to be like one page long, but it ended up being three pages because uh-huh. My imagination got the best of me. And so I wrote the story about where these spaceships come to Earth. They're in the shape of guitars, and uh-huh. it would come down and they would pick people up from planet Earth, and they would take them back to their purple planet. And everybody would sit in a lotus position, and they would have a third eye, and they wouldn't have to worry about food because vibration from music would feed them. And I was like, I must have been like 14 at the time when I wrote that, you know. And so I would like write stuff like that, but I also would write poetry as well. I had a poetry book. I don't uh-huh. know what I did with it. It's probably in the garbage by now. I don't know where it is. But I used to write stuff. Like I would just write poetry and stuff like what I was feeling. And it was always music related, you know, it was always music related all the time.
Yeah.
You know? Like just writing stuff. Like I would talk about like vibrations and sounds and what I heard and how get my like inspiration from people, and you know, or like you know, like I was like, for example, this is gonna sound odd, but as a kid I used to up the street, I used to there was these transmission lines, power lines, you know, high voltage lines that are and they get very loud too. You hear the snap and crackle. And I used to walk down in the bush, and I would sit there in the grass, and I would just listen to them crackle. And I would hear them, and it was, I could hear music through those lines. And I was like, man, I could hear that sound, and I want to apply that to the guitar. And so I was able to do that, uh-huh. you know, at least I'm still trying to. But I would hear the sounds of that, or I'm walking down the street, or I get a rock caught in my shoe, and it would hit against the ground a certain way, and there was a rhythm to it, you know, or a washing uh-huh. machine being unbalanced. And I would hear sounds from that, and I was like, oh, there's a rhythm in that. So I try to play to that, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, I would play the washing machine like tuk-tuk-tuk, and I'm sitting there playing to it, and of course my mother would be like, what are you doing? You almost about to damage the washing machine. Click, you know. But of course I would hear a rhythm, you know. And so uh-huh. that's how I heard things, you know. And I would hear music in that way, you know. But like between poetry or people talking, and sometimes there's a rhythm or a melody in their words. And so there's poetry to everything, and there's rhythm to a lot of different things. And so that's how I've always heard it. But yeah, not to go on a tangent, but yeah, poetry and music.
That was the best answer. I couldn't agree more. That's what I was hoping you would say without me saying it out loud, man, because that's exactly the way I feel, brother. That is amazing. Thank you. Thank you so much, man. Mike.
So, you know, I think one of the things that we have with this show is we have a lot of people who, you know, are almost always constantly working on their craft, but kind of see themselves as aspiring professional musicians or professional poets. In your mind, what's the difference between someone who is a skilled amateur and someone who's a professional, and coming at it from the craft kind of centered place you seem to be coming from, what do you see the difference being between the two?
Well, I never had thought about that. As far as skilled amateur professional, I guess I look at it like, how much do you really love playing? You know, how much time are you willing to spend by yourself? I'll put it even a better way. I call it this 3-point system that I have. And there are 3 types of players. The first one is the people who sort of want to do it. The middle is the people who want to do it. And the third is the people who want to do it badly. And you have to look at it, which one are you? Are you willing to spend time by yourself? Because being a musician is a lonely thing, because you have to spend time with yourself and you have to spend time with the instrument. And how much are you willing to do that? How much are you willing to, how badly do you want it? When you get up every day and you can't think of it, like for example, it's like, I get up and I play guitar before I even brush my teeth. Sometimes even not brushing teeth, walking around with bad breath, but because, you know, and not taking a shower because I want to play it so bad. You know, I get up in the morning and I can't think of nothing else but to do that. And it's like, that determines on who really, really wants to play it. Now, an amateur, you know, I it's hard for me to word it and think of it that way, but, I just have to put it, I guess, again, I would have to put it in the terms that I know best. It's like, it's a matter of how badly do you want it, you know? And sometimes it makes you just like, because you go through all the stuff. And the thing that, the word that's not used much anymore is paying your dues. That's a lost thing, you know, in such a thing. And it's just like, how much are you willing to pay your dues? You know, we're still paying our dues. We're always paying our dues. But it's, again, willing to pay your dues and how badly do you want it? How badly you to sit by yourself and go through it? And I mean, musicians, everybody's got the story that they've been ripped off. This has happened, you know. But at the end of the day, you know, like, if you can't think of nothing else, what brings a smile to your face, you know? And it's just like, I also think about it, like when you think about music, it's like when everything is too complicated, it's like, go back to the first time you picked up the instrument. What made you want to pick up the instrument in the first place? Go back to that, when you didn't know a thing about it. You didn't know anything about the chords or how to tune it. And you just banged away on it and it made you smile. You could just be like, ding, ding, ding. Didn't matter if you were hitting the wrong chord or whatever. You were just having fun. That's how you have to be every time. And some days you're going to have those days where you're just like, oh, it's rough. But at the end of the day, go back to the first time you picked it up. And what did you love about it? And bring that back. That's the thing.
It's we've had this, Mike and I never bring it up because we always want it to come naturally, or we don't want the listeners to feel like we somehow coerced it. But when you bring up paying your dues, I think that there are many artists, writers, who get quickly disenchanted with the music industry because they're not told you're gonna have to put in some mileage. It's gonna hurt. It's gonna hurt a little bit. You know, it's gonna be hurt. And I think I don't think people lie or they try to be deceitful. I think they don't want to scare musicians or writers, artists away from their genre. But it's kind of a disservice not to set them up for the same. And it's the same hard road that people going into the medical field or you know, attorneys, landscapers, anybody that wants to do their job well and stay with it. You got to put more than your nose to the grindstone. You know, you got to put your whole self.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, I mean, like you take somebody like James Brown, they called him the hardest working man in show business. Mm-hmm. He wasn't given that title for nothing. Mm-hmm. And he saw that, and James Brown saw it in others. He saw it in Michael Jackson. He knew Michael Jackson put in the work. Mm-hmm. Those people put in the work. They put their nose and they, like you said, they put their nose to the grind. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you have to be. You have to put in your 10,000 or more hours in. Yep. Because it can't be about instant gratification, like, okay, I want to grab the instrument, I want to be a rock star, and I'm going to be rich and make this. That's great. But if you're thinking only of that, then that might not come. But if you're not thinking about it and you're doing the music for the love and you're loving it because you want to do it, that will come.
It's true. It's true. And I mean, again, I used to, when I was growing up, thought it was so corny to say, but it's true. If you do get it that quick, you lose it that quick. Mm-hmm. Every time, because again, it's that mileage. And I know this is kind of common sense now to me, I mean, to us, but you know, when you put in that kind of rough mileage and you've done that hard sacrifice, when you do get it, you guard it fiercely and you're grateful mm-hmm. for it every day you have it. You're right.
Right. And you don't take nothing for granted, because it's just like, it's like I was a session player. You know what I mean? I had been doing session work. So that's what I was used to doing. You know, I never was a road person. I mean, I went on the road. My first time I went on the road was with a singer-songwriter. And I did that. And I wasn't ready for that because I'm used to being a homebody, you know, doing a session, going home. That's it, you know? And so the traveling thing is still, it's still kind of new to me because I'm not used to it. Uh-huh. But that's just, you know, the nature of the beast, you know? But at the end of the day, it's like, putting in the work, and you think about it, you think about the great legendary people, you know, and how much work they had to put in. And you read these stories, you read about like B.B. King, what he had to go through. You read about Aretha Franklin, what she had to go through. All these people, what did they have to go through? You know, Michael Jackson started off at 5 years old,
yeah,
you know, and he had to put in the work, you know, all the way to the very end, you know. And you see these people and you're just like, this is what made them great. People like, I remember knowing like one of my favorite people, you know, and of course she passed 5 years ago, Miss Sharon Jones. Mm-hmm. You know, I read her story, but I got to know her as a person.
Oh, nice.
And I know what she had went through before she got with the Dap Kings, and people doubted her because she had everything going against her, especially because of her age. Mm-hmm. But she still was like, I'm going to still go with it regardless in this environment. And she went with it mm-hmm. and she became who she became. And I know a lot of people in coal mine, everybody has a lot of respect for her and the Dap Kings because of what she had to endure,
yep.
You know? And it's just like, and I look at people who came before me who, if they didn't do what they did, I wouldn't be here where I am today. Basically, the saying goes, you're standing on the shoulders of giants so you can look farther.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
That's what it is.
It is.
You're standing on the shoulders of giants because you look farther. Because they're the ones who, yeah, you had a bush in your way, but then they paved that trail. They cleared all the brush. And it may have gotten to a certain point, but now it's you to continue that trail. But you're also on the shoulders of giants, so you can look further down and see, okay, where can that trail go? Where can that path go? So they may stop right there, but you're still like, okay, I can see it. Okay, now I'm going to get out here and pave the trail. Now somebody else will come along, they'll stand on your shoulder. They're like, oh, there's another path. They're going to cut another path. That's how I see it.
Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us. We want to thank Jimmy James for an incredible conversation. You can find Jimmy James at Jimmy Scratch James on Instagram. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or at southerncollectiveexperience.com. You can find myself at michaelamade.com, worldpoetrymagazine.com, and worldpoetryopenmic.com. Until next time, remember to be yourself. The world needs your authenticity. Do the hard work and conquer your obstacles creatively. Remember to follow your heart, for it's easy to lose your head in this business of music and poetry.